It is something Iran has accused the U.S. of before, yet the U.S. has failed in that regard, failing in making political decisions, which Iran has said has led to a halt in the Vienna talks. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the Iranian accusations against the U.S., one in which Iran has said that the U.S. is trying to hold the remaining issues hostage to its internal affairs. What those internal affairs are, and the chances of the JCPOA revival talks' success, are other issues we will look at in this edition of The Spotlight. To get the latest, first we're going to cross on over to Vienna and talk to our correspondent, Homolesky. Homolesky, at this point, we know that Iran is very critical of the U.S., not that it has not been before, but at this stage, it is pretty important. Tell us why.
Yeah, so let's look at the comments that have been made by Iranian top Iranian officials, the foreign minister himself, the foreign ministry spokesman, saying that when very recently Enrique Mora, the EU coordinator, came to Iran, the Iranians gave him the message or the response or the proposals on how to resolve the remaining issues. The red lines were clear. How far Iran was willing to go was clear. Now it's the U.S. that has to respond, and it has not done so. Here in Vienna, there were reports, of course, that the media tent outside the Coburg Palais Hotel is being dismantled. And in response to media reports about speculations as to what this means for the fate of the negotiations, the Russian ambassador, Mikhail Olyanov, tweeted, saying that because everything basically has already been written, the texts are already, and there are just these remaining issues between the Iranians and the Americans, once and if these issues are resolved, there'll only be a requirement for the participants to have a very short, in his words, meeting to announce formally the decision that they want to revive the JCPOA. But what Iran is asking now is the U.S. really willing to do that? Does it want the JCPOA to be revived? Because if it does, it has to adopt a realistic approach. It has to announce the political decision. What are the remaining issues from various reports we're hearing? It includes the scope of sanctions, the extent of sanctions that need to be rolled back, including those affecting Iran's IRGC, as well as guarantees that any future U.S. president would not withdraw from the JCPOA. So what we're seeing now in terms of how analysts, commentators are viewing the situation, they're saying this is the Biden administration that came into the White House with the campaign promise to undo what the Trump administration did when it came to the JCPOA. Ms. Biden was vehemently against the move by President Trump to withdraw from the JCPOA, but now they say he's effectively exploiting that decision and increasing pressure on Iran, especially since the U.S. also very recently introduced new sanctions on individuals and companies in Iran. Is there a will on the American side, Iran is asking, to make this happen? Because if they do resolve these very few issues that all participants believe can be resolved, then it is still realistic to assume that the JCPOA can come back to life.
Thank you very much for that. Homolesky there from Vienna. We do appreciate it. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have political analyst Saeed Mostafa Khoshesh, who joins us from Tehran. Also joining us, writer and political analyst John White, who joins us from Edinburgh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Saeed Mostafa Khoshesh. Iran has made some statements, and let's look at one of them, if you can break it down for us as to what it means. Khatibzadeh, the Iranian foreign ministry spokesperson, saying all of us should not forget that what we are facing today is not an administration that wants to perform its duties, but rather one that seeks to exploit legal means in order not to honor its obligations. What is he saying there?
Well, thanks for having me. Well, if you just take a look at what the Biden administration has been doing, it's just a continuation of the maximum pressure policy that came into effect under Donald Trump. Before even Biden came to office, Bolton, the former national security advisor, as well as many other Trump administration officials acknowledged that the maximum pressure policy has failed. Also, the Biden administration, Blinken, Jake Sullivan, Biden himself, they have all acknowledged that this policy has failed to produce any kind of result for the United States verbally. But when it comes into action, they still continue the same kind of policy. They continue the carrot and stick. They still continue imposing sanctions on Iran. And they're not at all apparently worried about the negotiations, since we are at the final stage of the talks, and they still continue imposing further sanctions on Iran and Iranians. So what they are doing basically is continuing Donald Trump's strategy. They are not really very much willing for honoring their duties and undertakings under the JCPOA. Otherwise, it wouldn't have required us to go into negotiations. They could have easily done that as soon as Biden came to office. He could have, resumed compliance with the terms of the JCPOA last year, even without the talks, because we are talking about very specific and clear and transparent undertakings of the United States and Iran under the JCPOA. Mm-hmm. But the Americans are not willing to, sure, relinquish their weapon of choice. That's the sanctions. That's why the talks have been stalled.
John White, we are looking at a date here of March 27th. That's when Enrique Mora, after visiting Tehran, departed with messages. He had met with high-ranking Iranian officials, including the Iranian foreign minister. And he left with messages from Tehran to Washington. Yeah. And according to what Iran is saying that we're still waiting for the answers from the other side. Mind you, that Iran did obviously make sure to, again, make it clear that the lack of the ability for the U.S. to make a political decision to remove the sanctions that are tied to economic benefits of the Iranian people is the only existing obstacle. At that point is what the Iranian foreign minister said to Enrique Mora. If that's the case, why is the U.S. not answering?
Well, thanks for having me. It's quite extraordinary that we've reached this point with regards to the negotiations in Vienna. On an objective, moral, ethical level, the U.S. should have long before now lifted the sanctions of Iran and agreed to resuscitate the JCPOA on the same terms as it was agreed initially in 2015. And Iran's foreign minister is absolutely correct when he says that Joe Biden is being held hostage by his own internal politics. His approval ratings have gone through the floor, now down to 39%. He's perceived by more and more Americans from their point of view as a weak leader. The Afghanistan debacle from their point of view in August last year, he's tried to play a strong card against Russia vis-a-vis the Ukraine conflict. That's only exacerbated the suffering of the American working class in terms of rising fuel prices and food prices. So it's quite inexplicable, if you understand this on a certain level, that the Biden administration will not acquiesce to Iran's reasonable demands. But you know what? Joe Biden has his biggest enemy is not Russia, it's not Iran, it's Donald Trump. And Trump is breathing down his shoulder. And this is where we are now with American politics. Joe Biden and the Democrats understand that Trump is likely to be re-elected in 2024 unless he plays tough with Iran vis-a-vis how Donald Trump did. And this is where the problem lies. The Iranians have nothing to apologize for. Joe Biden and his administration are being led down this path to perdition by Donald Trump and the pressure raised against him from the Republicans in the U.S. itself. It's a very sad state of affairs, but this is reality of a declining hegemonic power.
Well, I was going to ask this later, but let's get down to it, Sayyid Mostafa Hoshesh, regarding what John White is saying there. First of all, it's one of the guarantees that Iran does want is if a new administration does come, it needs to have some kind of guarantee that it's not going to rip up the agreement. But tell us about the deal with Congress. What is that all about? Looking at one particular source, Sayyid Mostafa Hoshesh, which says the president, Biden, will get his way because it's unlikely that Congress is going to be able to block a new agreement, and it refers back, based on this source and many other sources, actually, to when Obama actually went through and finally got its approval for the JCPOA at that point. So where does that stand?
You know, it's true that part of the problem comes from the very fact that the Biden administration is stuck with internal political disputes and rivalries and the problems that he might have domestically and especially at the Congress. But the very fact, I mean, a part of the fact is this point, that this is a U.S. strategy towards Iran. It's not just the Biden administration. It's not the Donald Trump administration policy. It's the U.S. policy that came into effect under Obama, even 9 months before Obama came to office. This is the containment strategy. They do not want a conflict resolution with Iran. Let's remember that Iran and the U.S. or its European allies, they have had six cases of agreements in the past two decades, one over Afghanistan, the other one 2003 over Iraq, three others with European states from 2003 to 2005, and the last one being the JCPOA in 2015. In all of them, according to U.S. officials and experts, Iran has been in full compliance with its undertakings, because Iran has always believed in a conflict resolution approach. And it has believed, rightly or wrongly, that the deal is for conflict resolution. But the United States and its allies, they have never been in compliance with the terms of all these deals, mainly removal of sanctions, because they have never meant to go for a conflict resolution approach. What they've been doing is going for a deal in line or in the framework of containment strategy. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? It means if we have a nuclear deal and everyone sticks to the deal, then they need to contain Iran's power components with regard to its missile industry, regional power, and its laser industry, nanotechnology, aerospace program, and so on and so forth. Because what they want to do is containing Iran's power. So the best weapon of choice that they got in here is the sanctions. So they always remain adamant to removing the sanctions. And now, right now, what is the problem with the talks that we don't see a deal? It's removal of sanctions on certain Iranian entities, legal and real persons, that includes actually Iranian individuals, firms, and entities that have been placed in the red list. And the U.S., which agreed a few months ago to remove them from the red list, has shown buyer's remorse. That's a known or notorious U.S. negotiating tactic. They have been doing this buyer's remorse all the time whenever they come to a deal with Iran and to the talks with Iran. Here, we are through with 97% of issues. But these the 3% left, this is very important, because if they remove this part of the sanctions from the red list of entities, firms, and individuals, then Iran would have a great more of, you know, economic merits from such a deal, and they do not want it to happen because they want to keep the sanctions structure intact. They might suspend some sanctions, but they do not want Iran to enjoy the full merits of any possible deal. That's why they are adamant to doing what is right.
Right. Well, let's talk about these sanctions that obviously they never come at a good time, but this is really at a very sensitive time, John White. And what message I'm going to ask you this sends, and particularly when we take a look also at the other angle of these sanctions, where it was basically on individuals and companies that are linked to Iran's ballistic missile program for providing assistance to Iran's ballistic missile program. I mean, they're targeting the defense of a country. You know, that's something that is Iran's red lines. So why would they go through with these sanctions?
Well, these are non-nuclear issues. These are incompatible with the original terms of the JCPOA that did not cover non-nuclear issues regarding, for example, as you just mentioned, Iran's ballistic missile program. Iran has a legitimate security interests, and they have a duty bound to their own people to uphold these security interests. This is trying to neuter Iran as a strong power in the region, and it's also a backhanded compliment, if I may say, to Iran's growing influence in the region as a pillar of stability in a region that's been mired in instability since the invasion of Iraq in 2003. But let's not be under any illusions. This is not just about US foreign policy. This is about Saudi and Israeli foreign policy. And they are having a major influence on the Biden administration's stance vis-a-vis these negotiations in Vienna. And it's a very sad state of affairs when you have a US president unsteady on his feet, cognitively challenged, who's struggling to maintain his own foreign policy. It is quite significant that his calls to the UAE and Saudi Arabia recently in the context of the Ukraine conflict to try and get them to produce more oil to stabilize energy prices globally were refused. That is quite unprecedented when you think about Washington's relationship and its influence in the Middle East. It is a waning power, and Joe Biden is a symptom of that waning power. So my suggestion to Iran, if I can say, is to stay firm, stand strong, and see this out, because the US is not the future. And I think the Iranian government and its institutions understand that. And that's why they're insisting that they will not budge from their demand that before anything can be agreed in Vienna, all sanctions must be lifted in accordance with the 2015 agreement.
Okay, let's get to one of the core issues that seems to be at hand here, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, and tell us if it is, because there are many that Iran has pointed out to. But when it comes to the IRGC, we're looking at obviously a red line and a key sticking point, and it doesn't make sense how this is a sticking point where it's a red line. And I'm going to put this into context and then ask you, how could this even be resolved in terms of it being on the terrorist list organization, as the U.S. has done, when the U.S. Special Envoy, Robert Malley, has said that sanctions on the IRGC would remain in place even if an agreement to restore the deal is reached?
Okay. First of all, this is not the main point that has been left. This is it is one of the very few points that have been left. The most important issue, as I just said, is removing sanctions on specific legal and real persons that includes firms, individuals, and entities in the SDN list or the so-called red list that's a part of the SDN list, that they remain adamant to removing the sanctions on these individuals and entities, because removing sanctions from these entities, individuals, and firms would enhance economic merits for Iran under any possible view. And this is very important because I'll explain about it. Removing, IRGC from the list, the IRGC has been tagged multiple times. If I'm not mistaken, under four tags, it's been sanctioned. One of them is the SDGT. If they remove this tag, there will be economic merits for Iran. But when it comes to FTO, or Foreign Terrorist Organization, because of supporting resistant movements in the region, this is just a political tag. It doesn't include economic merits. It's just a political sanctions. It is the worst. It's the worst type of, tag or sanction on, any country or an organization or a military, an official military of the country. And by the way, the IRGC is the official military, the army of Iran, and no other military in the world has been sanctioned by the U.S. or any other country. This is something very illegal, like other U.S. sanctions on Iran and other countries and companies throughout the world. But this FTO, as I just said, is just a political tag. If they remove it, it means a very great defeat for the United States that tagged the IRGC on their FTO a couple of years ago. Actually, not a couple, but in 2018, they placed it under the FTO in the FTO list. But its removal would not entail any economic merits for Iran. That's why I and some other experts insist that Iran should also continue its insistence on removing the SDGT tag as well. This is one of the other key issues. I'm not hearing about it very often in the media, but this is one more point that needs to go under discussions. And in a few more months, as the global developments are, you know, especially with regard to the Russian confrontation with the West over Ukraine, as things are developing, especially in the energy market, soon we will see that if there is to be a deal, definitely the United States would be required to do more and to give more points and to give more merits, including removing of the SDGT from the IRGC.
John White, this administration is very keen, and Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, while running for presidency, said that we are going to enhance our relations with our neighbors, and it's doing so, and we can see the results. One of them being the major one, I'm guessing here, which is still in the works somewhat, is its relation with Saudi Arabia. Of course, we have that major development come where the Iranian Foreign Minister, Amir Abdullahian, spoke to the UN Secretary General Guterres and spoke about the JCPOA revival talks, and also the fact that there was a ceasefire between Yemen, the official government of Yemen, and Saudi Arabia, a ceasefire for 2 months at this point. Do you think then that this is something that may lead to, I guess I'm just going to say, the U.S. realizing that Iran is taking the right steps in order to regionally calm things down, because it's doing all it can diplomatically with its neighbors, yeah, or not?
Well, in the West, in the context of the conflict in Ukraine, ideology has superseded pragmatism, and that's always a bad position to be. That is the road to perdition. And I think Iran is an absolute arbiter of pragmatism over ideology. Iran is willing to forge bilateral productive relations with all its neighbours, including Saudi Arabia, despite all the enmity that has existed between those two countries for many, many years. And I think that pragmatism will always trump, no pun intended, ideology in the last analysis. I think the US has to understand, if it tries to cancel Russia and its energy supplies, it has to allow Iran's oil to be a part of the world energy market in order to stabilize global prices. Because ultimately, when people go to fill their cars up in California or New York or any part of the US, that will determine the political trajectory of that country. And the Biden administration must understand that it must acquiesce to the reality of the condition of the American people in terms of its economy. And that is a problem that Biden has.
Right.
He's been pushed by ideologues in his own administration in Washington to take these very radical steps, and it's going to be his undoing.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. But thank you for that, John White, writer and political analyst. Saeed Mostafa Khoshesh, also thank you for your input. Political analyst spoke to us from Tehran. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitapoy and the entire team, it's goodbye.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أرأيت من اتخذ إلهه هواه أفأنت تكون عليه وكيلا
Have you seen the one who takes as his God his own desire? Then would you be responsible for him?
So we were discussing the 43rd verse of this chapter Furqan. أرأيت من اتخذ إلهه هواه أفأنت تكون عليه وكيلا Have you seen him who takes his low desires for his God? Would you then be a guardian over him? Previously, dear listeners, we said that in this verse, any other God other than the Almighty Allah is called Hawa, which is the main root of all evil and all idol worshipping. We also discussed the different commentaries mentioned by the great scholars and the fact that the nature of man is... Having various instincts and desires, and the point is to control these desires. Sometimes they imprison the intellect, sometimes they rule the whole existence of humanity. They take him under their control, and this is when the problem begins. That is why the Prophet of Islam has counted the idol of low desire as the worst idol. The Holy Quran, brothers and sisters, has also considered worshipping low desires, or the so-called sensuality, the source of paganism and faithlessness. The Holy Quran says in chapter Taha, the 16th verse, فَلَا يَصُدَّنَّكَ عَنْهَا مَنْ لَا يُؤْمِنُ بِهَا وَاتَّبَعَ هَوَاهُ فَتَرْدَى Therefore, let him who believes not in it and follows his own vain desires turn you away from it, lest you perish. Fatarda. It means the result of following such a person is that you will be perished. Moreover, worshipping low desires is the worst kind of misleading. As the Holy Quran says, وَمَنْ أَضَلُّ مِمَّنْ اتَّبَعَ هَوَاهُ بِغَيْرِ هُدًى مِّنَ اللَّهِ Who goes further astray than he who follows his lust without guidance from Almighty Allah? Another matter is that worshipping low desires is the opposite of truth-seeking, and it deviates man from the path of Allah. The Holy Quran in chapter Sa'd, the 26th verse, says, فَحْكُمْ بَيْنَ النَّاسِ بِالْحَقِّ وَلَا تَتَّبِعِ الْهَوَى فَيُذِلَّكَ عَن سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ Therefore, judge between mankind with justice, and do not follow desire, lest it should lead you astray from the way of Allah. Furthermore, worshipping low desires prevents justice and pursuit of fairness, since the Holy Quran has mentioned, therefore do not follow any passion so that you can deal justly.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So, in brief, when worshipping of low desires rules, there is neither religion nor intellect. There is only pain and disaster in the society. There will be only wretchedness, corruption, and barbarity in there. The phenomena of our life and bitter experiences that we have about others and ourselves are live evidence of all points that we discussed so far about following low desires. In the episodes we were discussing this holy verse, we tried to have a look at the consequences of following low desires throughout the verses of the Holy Quran and also our narrations. We have seen, we have experienced ourselves who suffer the consequences of 1 hour of worshipping low desires till the end of their lives. Sometimes we have seen young people who, as a result of following their low desires, have become addicted to drugs. And then they have got sexually and morally deviated. And then they're changed into a miserable, worthless, and disabled creature. They have lost all their power and capitals because of following low desires for a few seconds or minutes. But the different verses of the Holy Quran suggest if you follow your low desires, فَتَرْدَى. If you see someone following his low desires, أَفَأَنْتَ تَكُونُ عَلَيْهِ وَكِيلًا. The one who his low desires are governing him, the one whose low desires are ruling him, no one can guide, no one can be a guardian over, even you as the Prophet. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode of the program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see. All the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Exactly 1 week before the first round of the French election, the embodiment of the past 5 years marched in Paris. Yellow vests who were crippled, blinded, and mutilated by police. On every Saturday from November 2018 until June 2019, a national bloodletting took place on a scope which was unprecedented in recent Western history. The numbers are as staggering as the lack of Western condemnation for the French government. At least 11,000 arrests, 1,000 imprisoned, 5,000 protesters seriously hurt, 1,000 critically injured, scores maimed for life, and 11 deaths. Those who suffer the most say they don't want to be forgotten when voters go to the ballot box.
When you're mutilated by the police, there's naturally a lot of suffering and a lot of complications to our daily lives. But we keep our head held up high to show what Mr. Macron has done to his own people.
The huge phalanx of armed police, which still accompany the yellow vests every Saturday, kept their distance, while the mainstream media was not present at the protest almost at all.
It is the average citizens who supports us, because we do not even exist to the state or to the justice system. Where there is no police brutality and there are no victims, then how can we exist?
Over 75% of cases involving hurt protesters are immediately dropped without any court case or even an investigation. punishment of police for mistreating yellow vest anti-government protesters has been almost non-existent.
Donc au départ, le gouvernement là...
By denying that there was any police brutality, the government legitimized it. How can we have confidence in a government which cripples its own citizens or in institutions which do not intervene to stop that? It is truly barbaric violence which chose to mutilate people simply because they believe in a better future.
The yellow vests are routinely credited with an approval rating of 75%, an unheard of score in a country where perceptions of political corruption are commonplace. The state-sponsored police brutality, combined with the so-called anti-yellow vest laws, scared many into no longer attending public protests. President Emmanuel Macron is expected to win a close re-election, but the damage to France's international reputation cannot be estimated. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
It was a day of high drama and surprises in Pakistan. The country's parliament was to vote on a no-trust move against Prime Minister Khan. But the deputy speaker blocked the vote by ruling that the opposition's move was part of an international conspiracy against the government.
No foreign power has the right to topple the elected government through a conspiracy. The points raised by the law minister are valid, therefore I disallow and dismiss the vote of no confidence move.
Within minutes, Prime Minister Khan appeared on national television and dissolved the parliament.
President Sahib ko.
After the ruling of the speaker, I have advised the president to dissolve the assemblies. And in democratic society, change must come through elections. People, not the foreign powers, should decide who they want in power.
Elections.
Khan claims he was being ousted from power by the US for pursuing independent foreign policy. But opposition parties have rejected the move and termed it a violation of the constitution.
Banana Republic.
The government has tried to show that Pakistan is a banana republic. Pakistan is a growing democracy, and we will not allow anyone to violate the constitution.
Khan came to power in 2018 and promised to bring reforms in the country. Opposition accused him for failing to deliver on his promise and hence wanted to seek his ouster. But the speaker's move to reject opposition's vote of no confidence has triggered a constitutional crisis in the country.
The focus has now shifted from the parliament to the Supreme Court of Pakistan. The country's highest court will decide whether the speaker's ruling and subsequent decision by the prime minister to dissolve the parliament is constitutional or not. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
As the sun sets, this divine voice calls for prayer. But during the fasting month of Ramadan, it also means that the fasting hours are over and Muslims can eat iftar or the breakfast. In Iran, the Ramadan crescent was sighted on the eve of Sunday, so Sunday was announced as the first day of the holy month.
Ramadan is not just about abstention from eating and drinking. It's a time to purify your soul and contemplate on your mission as a human being. It's an occasion to pray and get closer to God.
This holy month is a perfect time to be the best version of ourselves. We take part in charity works and try to be kind to people around us. It is a month of God and it is so beautiful.
This is the third year in a row that Muslims observe the fasting month amid the coronavirus pandemic. But this year, COVID restrictions are eased as the pandemic has partly subsided.
It's the first time after more than 2 years that Muslims mark Ramadan without serious worries over the coronavirus. With the majority being vaccinated, the holy month will once again see Muslims getting together for mass religious ceremonies and prayers.
Taking part in congregational prayers is one of the rituals Muslims do before iftar. Last year, such ceremonies were largely curtailed due to the pandemic. This was also the case for the 19th, 21st, and 23rd nights of Ramadan, known as the Nights of Glory, when Muslims congregated mosques to pray and make wishes.
This year, we will host worshippers for the Nights of Glory. During the past 2 years, praying ceremonies were either cancelled or held with social distancing and with a limited participation to curb the pandemic.
Last year and the year before, I caught the virus and couldn't fast the entire month of Ramadan. But thank God, this year everyone is vaccinated and we can observe the holy month together.
Ramadan is the ninth month of the Islamic lunar calendar. Based on this calendar, months begin and end depending on the movement of the moon in its orbit around the earth. And the start of each month depends on the sighting of the new moon the day before. The holy month will end with a major festivity called Eid al-Fitr, or the festival of breaking the fast. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Some 2 million Gazans are observing another holy month of Ramadan under the Israeli blockade for the 16th time in a row. Muslims around the world enjoyed this holy month while people in Gaza struggled to observe it under inhumane conditions. People in the tiny coastal enclave have limited access to food and they are also denied the right to freedom of movement. During this holy month of Ramadan, most Gazans are impoverished as their incomes continue to dwindle because of the crippling Israeli blockade.
The situation in Gaza, especially during the holy month, is very difficult. Poverty and unemployment rates are very high, and people can hardly afford to buy food to prepare their meals and break their fasting.
People usually shop for food items to prepare their iftar meals a few hours before iftar time, which takes place at dusk. Gazans, meanwhile, find it very hard to prepare their fast-breaking iftar meals due to the harsh economic conditions.
Ramadan is a wonderful month, but people are having a hard time because of the Israeli blockade. There is no purchasing power, and most people just walk around the goods while hardly buying anything.
According to UN reports, the majority of people living in the Gaza Strip are receiving some sort of aid to survive. Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed, and poor people have been getting poorer year after year.
Israel work against the international law. The siege is continued at the time we are in the beginning of Ramadan. Blockade means poverty. Blockade means high average of unemployment.
Experts say the Israeli regime has been fueling misery and suffering in the tiny coastal sliver.
Thousands of Gazan families can't afford to buy food to prepare their Ramadan meals amid the dire economic situation. They mainly blame the suffering on the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
As Yemenis are marking the holy month of Ramadan, a new truce was announced by the United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen to help the humanitarian situation in the country. The parties agreed to a nationwide ceasefire for 2 months, in addition to suspending all sorts of aerial attacks from both parties.
The international community has become convinced that this unjustified and barbaric aggression against the Yemeni people must be stopped. And the violations and crimes left by the war are a disgrace to the international community. There are indications of the continuation of the truce, and we hope that it will be the beginning of a complete end to the war and the lifting of the siege on Yemen so that we can confront the humanitarian crisis.
The agreement includes opening Sana'a Airport for 2 flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan only, and allowing Yemen's fuel ships to arrive at Hudaydah Port. However, observers say this agreement is the result of the recent attacks of Yemen's armed forces against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia.
I think, of course, those latest attack against Saudi Arabia and as well in the last few months against United Arab Emirates, it has forced Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates to accept this truce. But it will be really clear in the coming days and week, will they accept this and will they, because there have been many like agreement that has been signed as an example in Stockholm. But still at that time, because Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates were not part of this agreement, they have not signed and they were not mentioned in any of those agreements. That's why they have actually not respecting them.
In addition to the war, Saudi Arabia has been tightening the all-out blockade it imposes on Yemen and has prevented Yemen's fuel ships to enter the country. This has worsened the situation in war-torn Yemen, which is already going through the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the UN. Despite the tragic humanitarian situation in their country, Yemenis say there has always been light despite all the darkness. They believe the UN brokered agreement may lead to a comprehensive political solution as the Saudi war must come to an end. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A fresh round of violence by the Israeli military has erupted in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin refugee camp, killing two Palestinians and wounding 15 others. The army stated that its forces stormed the camp to arrest suspects in connection to Tuesday night's operation in Bnei Brak, one of Tel Aviv's suburbs, which led to the killing of five Israelis and the perpetrator Diya Hamashi from Ya'bet town near Jenin. During the funeral procession of the two youths in Jenin, mourners vowed to avenge their killing, saying the operation was meant to satisfy the angry settlers.
Israeli forces raided Jenin's refugee camp and the city with large numbers of armored vehicles to kill people in cold blood and to commit more crimes just to satisfy the settlers. It's a criminal regime with its military.
Following Jenin's raid, Israel declared a military operation, dubbed Wave Breaker, to stem what it described as a rising tide of terrorism by Palestinians. In 1 week, Tel Aviv was shocked by three lethal series of operations in lands occupied since 1948, leaving 11 Israelis dead.
The current Zionist regime doesn't want an escalation to keep its internal status, despite a call for Israelis to carry arms. At the same time, it gives the settlers free hand along with the military practices.
A third Palestinian man was also shot dead after claims he stabbed and injured an Israeli man with a screwdriver on a bus near the illegal settlement of Efrat and Gush Atzion settlement block between Bethlehem and El Khalil. The Israelis are calling for a military campaign in the occupied West Bank, demanding a painful response. On the other hand, Palestinian resistance groups have vowed to respond to Israeli crimes, saying they have their hand on the trigger. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
In France, the suburbs around cities are known for being poor, immigrant, often Muslim, and for voting for the left. But a new poll shows that the far right has surged in popularity. At 42% of voter intentions, the far right has become as popular as the three centrist parties combined. It's now only the poorest areas of the suburbs where the stereotype of the so-called red suburb still holds. Overall, 60% of the suburbs are planning to vote for the two political extremes, in a major rejection of the two mainstream parties and President Emmanuel Macron's new party.
These areas feel abandoned by the city centers and the political elite there. So their turn to the political extremes is actually a protest vote. They have a desire to try a different type of politics because they feel that in recent decades, things have only gotten worse for themselves and for France. After decades of alternating power, the mainstream parties are not coming back.
In 2017, the National Front's Marine Le Pen lost in a 66-34% landslide. However, the latest polls show a 53-47% race, which is now within the margin for error. Many Muslims say they are ready to do what was once unthinkable, vote for the far right. Analysts say that suburbs are now voting similar to rural areas and for similar reasons.
10 years ago, people may have voted based on identity issues, but this election is all about class. What we hear voters talking about is inflation, the loss of public services, and unemployment. Mainstream parties don't have a good record on these issues, which have been ignored in this campaign, making these voters even angrier.
The national turn to the right is based on pocketbook issues. But people may also have been persuaded by what's been on the nightly news all year long. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
In his 50-minute televised address on Thursday, Pakistan's embattled Prime Minister Imran Khan came up with serious allegations against the U.S.
They say they're angry with Pakistan. They make this excuse. They say they will forgive Pakistan if Imran Khan loses in the no-trust move. But if the move fails, Pakistan will have to go through a difficult time.
The so-called threat letter was based on the conversation between the Pakistani ambassador in Washington and the U.S. officials. According to the government, U.S. officials were unhappy with Pakistan over its neutral stance on the Russia-Ukraine crisis. The letter then goes on to say that Pakistan would be isolated if the vote of no confidence against Imran Khan failed. This has led the government to conclude that the no-trust move of opposition has the backing of the U.S. Pakistan has summoned a senior diplomat in Islamabad and lodged a formal protest over the controversy.
It's a serious thing, very serious, that pertains to Pakistan's national security. And the onus lies on the Prime Minister Imran Khan that he should bring forth, tell the nation, tell the stakeholders that what is the conspiracy.
Opposition parties have strongly rejected allegations that the U.S. was behind their no-confidence motion. The government also says it has uncovered a plot to assassinate Prime Minister Khan. All this is happening just ahead of the crucial vote of no-confidence against the Prime Minister on Sunday.
Prime Minister Khan is linking the vote of no-confidence with a foreign conspiracy. Despite losing a majority in the parliament, the embattled Prime Minister insists he would not step down. This means the political battle would go all down to the wire. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
As the conflict in Ukraine grinds on, almost 7 million are displaced inside the country and about 4 million people have left their homes in search of shelter abroad. These numbers are increasing on a daily basis. So far, almost 80,000 Ukrainians have arrived in Italy, the majority of whom are women and children, with the most popular destinations being big cities like Milan, Rome and Naples. At the beginning of the war, about 3,000 people were arriving in Italy from Ukraine every day, but now the numbers seem to have slowed. On Thursday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi praised the UN for its contribution to the handling of the refugee crisis.
The UN has been very active in designing humanitarian programs for Ukraine refugees. Bear in mind that while Poland and Romania have received millions of Ukrainians, almost 80,000 refugees have reached Italy so far and about 300,000 have landed in Germany.
Amid the wave of support provided to Ukrainian refugees, aid groups operating in conflict-stricken areas have warned that non-Ukrainians who are trying to flee from Ukraine are facing a number of additional challenges, including legal exclusion from certain forms of help and racial discrimination. Over 2 million refugees, more than half of the 4 million who have fled the conflict so far, have crossed from Ukraine into Poland. According to figures from the Polish border guards, around 4% are not Ukrainian nationals and include significant numbers of African and Asian students. Reports have emerged that many non-Ukrainians have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
This is unlawful. Everyone has the right to leave Ukraine under these circumstances. Ukrainians, with exception of male Ukrainians who are under military rule, but all foreigners in Ukraine, of course, have to be admitted to the neighboring country, Poland, Hungary or other countries.
Members of the bloc, including Italy, have ratified a 2001 EU directive which grants temporary protection in the event of a mass influx of displaced persons. However, non-Ukrainians have been excluded from the temporary protection scheme.
In this directive, it is foreseen that only those who are directly concerned with a country in crisis are entitled for temporary protection, citizens of that country, and refugees recognized previously in that country, and that other citizens is up to the member states to determine if they would benefit from the temporary protection.
So far, 17 billion euros have been allocated from the EU for Ukrainian refugee reception. However, uncertainty remains around quotas and relocations. Max Civili, Rome.
in the limelight.
Hundreds of Palestinians were killed in Tantura in cold blood. They were buried in mass graves, the largest of which is believed to be under a parking lot. The Tantura massacre and its aftermath is arguably the most glaring representation of the Zionist regime's criminality. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ramzi Barud, journalist and editor-in-chief of Palestine Chronicle. This article